We're going to be talking about cholinergic receptors again today. We've talked about one type of cholinergic receptors previously. Anybody remember what those were? Nicotinic. Okay. This slide should be something somewhat familiar to you. Please don't try to write everything on the slide down. Okay. But most of you are probably familiar with the autonomic nervous system. The fact that a significant portion of it exists outside the central nervous system. And we have preganglionic cells that are found within the spinal cord or in the brainstem that release acetylcholine onto ganglionic neurons. And the receptors on those ganglionic neurons we talked about previously are what type of receptors? Nicotinic. And that's what the N in this diagram stands for. Then we have the parasympathetic and sympathetic branches of the nervous system. And the primary neurotransmitter for the ganglionic cells in the parasympathetic, the example here is the vagus nerve, is acetylcholine again, primarily acting through muscarinic receptors. We're going to be talking about muscarinic receptors again today. And the sympathetic nervous system, where the cell bodies are found in the chain ganglia close to the spinal cord, the primary postganglionic neurotransmitter is norepinephrine, an adrenergic neurotransmitter acting through both alpha and beta receptors. And we'll be talking about norepinephrine, I believe, next week. But I should point out that there is some cholinergic transmission in the sympathetic nervous system as well, acting through muscarinic receptors. And that's on to sweat glands and some blood vessels. So it's not exclusively norepinephrine as the postganglionic transmitter, even in the sympathetic nervous system. In fact, there's some dopamine transmission in the sympathetic nervous system too, and we'll be talking about dopamine next week as well. Okay. But for today, we're going to concentrate on muscarinic receptors and on acetylcholine. So that's one source of acetylcholine in the peripheral nervous system. How about in the central nervous system? There's an awful lot of acetylcholine in the brain and not targeted just at nicotinic receptors. Even though we talked about, say, the alpha 7 nicotinic receptors and how they're different from other types of nicotinic receptors, well, there's also five varieties of muscarinic receptors found in the central nervous system that receive acetylcholine. And it comes essentially from three regions in the nervous system. Back in the brainstem, there are two very large cholinergic nuclei. Anyone ever heard of the ventral tegmental area before? VTA? Well, this is the cholinergic equivalent, the dorsal tegmental nucleus. Not ventral, but dorsal tegmental. Tegmentum, again, those of you that are familiar with a little bit of neuroanatomy, is the area below the colliculi or below the tectal region in the nervous system. So tegmentum is in the pontine region below the colliculus. There's also what's called the pedunculopontine nucleus. Pedunculopontine nucleus. How many of you took integrative last semester? What's the pedunculopontine nucleus important for? Somebody speak clearly. Anybody? I heard the right answer out there.
Is it part of the reticular activation?
Well, it's part of the reticular formation, yeah. It plays an important role in REM sleep, particularly the lack of muscle tone in REM sleep. But it also has ascending projections as well. And so these are both critically important in normal daily function, these sort of brainstem cholinergic nuclei. Then we have one that we've talked about previously, the habenula. Now everybody has heard of the habenula before, correct?
Okay.
Okay. And that's sort of in the middle of the brain, right directly beside the pineal gland. And in fact, for volume, it has a higher concentration of acetylcholine than any of the other cholinergic nuclei. And then we have important forebrain sources of acetylcholine. One that's studied very extensively by Dr. Kilgard's lab, the NBM, the nucleus basalis of Meynert, which is not just a cholinergic nuclei, as I'll show in a moment, but actually more extensively a GABAergic nucleus as well. Then we have the nucleus of the diagonal band, the NDB, which is essentially part of the motor system. It's a portion of the ventral striatum, nucleus of the diagonal band. And then the medial septum. If the nucleus basalis is the major source of cortex for the cerebral cortex, the medial septum is the major source for archicortex, the hippocampus. So lots of different sources of acetylcholine in the nervous system. And then also these things that are shown as little squiggly neurons out here. These are what we call intrinsic cholinergic systems. Most forebrain areas have intrinsic neurons that generate their own acetylcholine so that they can further refine the cholinergic signaling locally on a very fine local spatial scale, but also fine-tuning it on the temporal dimension as well. So acetylcholine is critical for most of your daily function. If we look in different regions of the nervous system where acetylcholine is produced, we can identify the cholinergic neurons using a stain for this particular enzyme, choline acetyltransferase. The way you properly pronounce this is cat. It doesn't look like the word cat you learned in kindergarten, but neuroscientists tend to be spelling impaired. So cat. CHAT, choline acetyltransferase. That's the critical biosynthetic enzyme that's used to produce acetylcholine. And we'll look at biosynthesis of acetylcholine in just a minute. So if we look for neurons, and again, the projector here and the lights in this room don't really help. But over on the left, you can see at least one neuron, but you know that's a neuron because it's got neuro-specific proteins. And it's also positive for choline acetyltransferase. So you know that that is a cholinergic neuron. The others, they're all in black and white, but that's also staining for choline acetyltransferase. So if we look in, for instance, well, this is actually within the nucleus basalis. And it turns out that about 60% of the neurons there don't stain for choline acetyltransferase, but instead stain for the biosynthetic enzyme for GABA, okay, which is GAD. When we look in other regions of the nervous system, like the septal region, it provides the cholinergic input to the hippocampus. The ratio there between GABA and acetylcholine ends up being about the same too. About 60% GABAergic, about 40% acetylcholine. If we look in some of these pontine nuclei, they tend to be a mixture between inhibitory neurons and cholinergic neurons. Okay. Habenula is one of the exceptions. It's almost exclusively cholinergic. And these pictures here in the neocortex, here in the campus, show some of the local cholinergic neurons that are located within those regions. They're not nuclei, but they're cholinergic neurons that carry out local functions within those regions to fine-tune the cholinergic signal. Okay. So if you had to identify a cholinergic neuron, what kind of marker would you look for? Cat. All right. Don't ever expect you to be able to draw the different molecules involved, but you should know the relationship between the substrates, the enzymes, and the products here. For biosynthesis of acetylcholine, we start with two substrates. Acetyl-CoA, if you're really interested in the structure, I wouldn't suggest drawing it out right now, but this is the full structure of acetyl-CoA, and an amino acid, choline. Those are acted upon by choline acetyltransferase, CAT, that we just talked about, to yield two products. One is the neurotransmitter, acetylcholine, or acetylcholine, if you prefer that pronunciation, and CoA. So it's a one-step process. It's not nearly as complicated as some of the other biosyntheses we've looked at. To break down acetylcholine, to get rid of it, you take the neurotransmitter as the substrate. It's acted upon by an enzyme called acetylcholine esterase. Cholinesterase. And as products, you yield acetate, which can actually be used in the Krebs cycle, and one of the necessary amino acids for regenerating acetylcholine. Choline. So you recycle the acetylcholine. There's some seats over that way.
Notice this little arrow here, too. There are an awful lot of drugs that inhibit this regulatory enzyme.
We'll be talking about a lot of them that are clinically relevant or that could unfortunately end your life. And many of them you're exposed to on a daily basis. Anticholinesterases that inhibit the breakdown of acetylcholine. Turns out having acetylcholine around for too long is not a good thing. In synapses, we have high levels. Anywhere acetylcholine is released, we have high levels of cholinesterase molecules. They exist in lots of different isoforms, structurally different but chemically related forms. So over at the right-hand side here, we do a stain for cholinesterases. You can see where acetylcholine is released in large quantities in the nervous system. Anybody know in the rat brain what region that might be? This region in the middle here?
Basal ganglia.
Basal ganglia, caudate and putamen. Okay. Other portions of the brain, you'll see heavy staining too. You notice cortex is darker than the areas medial to cortex there as well. Whenever acetylcholine is released, it takes tens of microseconds to diffuse to the receptor, and typically within hundreds of microseconds, it's been degraded by cholinesterases. So most cholinergic signals are very short in duration. So if you introduce a drug that blocks cholinesterase activity, you can profoundly disrupt normal physiological cholinergic function. And have very dire consequences as a result. So let's look at some anticholinesterase drugs. Yeah, don't panic at the size of the chart yet. Let's break it down. We've got a list of drugs over on the left-hand side, and only a few of them are in color. We've got a column here that's labeled duration. And here, duration can either be very long or irreversible. What would an irreversible duration mean? like a suicide antagonist, but this isn't a receptor. But it stays bound to the enzyme for longer than the life cycle of that enzyme protein molecule. So essentially takes it out of operation. More interesting, really, is this far right-hand column, the use of these compounds. I've got two uses listed. One is insecticides. The other is a term that we've become very familiar with since, 2003 or so.
Weapons of mass destruction.
WMDs. Another term that we might substitute there is nerve gas. These are organophosphate compounds on this chart. That means they have a lot of phosphate groups in their molecular structure.
This is one that is still held in reasonable quantities, not reasonable, well, actually unreasonable quantities, in ton quantities by the militaries in many countries. Sarin. It's actually been used by some terrorist organizations.
What country's been in the news lately for earthquakes and tsunamis?
Japan.
It was used in the 1990s in a subway attack in Japan. Killed a number of people. The people handling it didn't understand its properties, or they would have killed a lot more. Because at least one or more of them died before they fully opened the container so they could expose lots of people to it. Very small quantities are sufficient to kill. What's its duration of action? It's irreversible. So once that enzyme is knocked out, you have to generate new enzymes. In the meantime, you're not able to breathe, and your heart rate is not regulated. So it's hard to stay alive long enough to generate new enzyme activity. Hence its categorization as a weapon of mass destruction. Small quantities could eliminate, somewhere less than a microgram could probably take out everyone in this room. Doesn't take much. So imagine what tons of it can do.
Another chemical used to be very commonly applied, not as a weapon of mass destruction, but as an insecticide, pesticide, DDT.
It's illegal
in the U.S. Still widely manufactured by U.S.-based companies, though, not made in the U.S., but the patents are owned in the U.S., and then used on foodstuffs in the rest of the world.
They get shipped to the U.S.?
Food gets shipped to the U.S. Anybody been in a grocery store lately? Was there lots of fresh fruit and vegetables? You think this is the right season in the U.S. for growing fresh fruit and vegetables?
No.
No? So you may have been exposed to DDT and never known it. Probably really small quantities. But again, it's irreversible in its action. It takes those enzymes out of the picture permanently. Most other things that are designed these days as insecticides, which you can go to any drugstore, grocery store, hardware store, probably even 7-Eleven, and buy things like diazinon or malathion, are not irreversible. They're just very long-acting. In this case, long-acting typically means more than 24 hours. So guess what? If you get a high enough dose of those, they will kill you just as dead as the irreversible ones. And in the state of Texas, you periodically see somebody working on a farm reported they dumped a 55-gallon drum of an insecticide on themselves, and it died within the next few minutes afterwards. So it wasn't mass destruction in that case. But for that particular individual, they're just as dead as if they had been exposed to a nerve gas. Very effective on insects, Number one, they have fewer neurons. So you only have to take out a few neurons and you've disabled them. Their neurons are also more exposed because they have an exoskeleton and their musculature is more exposed than ours is. We thankfully have a little more redundancy in our nervous system. But you get a high enough dose of any of these compounds and they can take you out too. So these are the organophosphate anticholinesterases. They're typically not licensed by the FDA for human consumption, but they will allow you to have a certain amount of residues on the food that you eat if they're considered an acceptable level. Problem with acceptable levels, we don't excrete these compounds. They're very lipid soluble, so they tend to bioaccumulate. Everyone know what that means? When a biological entity consumes them, they stay in that entity. Anyone here eat lots of plants, fruits? How about anyone here that's not a vegetarian or a vegan? Those animals eat those things too. They bioaccumulate in all of the protein sources. And then you ingest those loads as well. So it's not just the fruits and vegetables you eat, but everything else that the food that you eat ate that you accumulate. So over a life cycle, you can accumulate pretty significant doses, even if it was, say, femtogram quantities that you were taking in originally. Because you eat every day. Are they just in foods? No, they wash off the land that they're applied to, get into the water supply. So these are very bioactive substances. So we're essentially a walking experiment right now for the long-term effects of these. She's still alive. Believe it or not, these are not naturally occurring compounds. These have been devised within the last 100 years or so. So we are a fairly recent experiment at this point in time. Then again, there's probably a lot more people alive because of these, rather than dead because of these, because less of our food crops are consumed by insects. But then again, nowadays, people won't buy food products, at least if you go in the fruit and vegetable section, if it looks like an insect even looked at them, much less chewed on them. So now we essentially demand that things be treated that way. Or we buy what people call organic produce. Guess what? You can be organic and still have pesticides applied, as long as they're, quote, organic pesticides. So that doesn't get you away from this problem either.
Organophosphate?
No, not organophosphate, though. Things like pyrethroids and things like that that inhibit phosphatases?
Yeah.
That we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
So is there a benefit to eating organic food?
That's a philosophical question, and I'm not sure we're ready to fully discuss that. They're probably, in terms of sustainability of being able to produce the food, there probably are long-term benefits.
Just the health benefit?
That scientific data is not strong in support of that at this point. It really depends on how it's organically produced, as much as anything. There certainly are probably some detrimental effects to massive uses of pesticides. But there's lots of other chemicals that we use all the time, too. If we eliminated just the pesticides, that wouldn't get rid of our chemical exposure. How about clinically relevant drugs? Not bug spray, but something that you might get a prescription for or be treated with in a hospital. Again, there's a long list of names.
Notice a number of them have this suffix, stigmine. Stigmine. Many, but not all of the clinically relevant ones have that stigmine suffix. And sort of the prototypical one is physostigmine.
Physostigmine. What's its duration of action? Short. A few hours' time, tops. Not days, not the rest of your life. However short your life might be if you're exposed to those irreversible ones.
This is another one that you're probably going to hear a lot about. Diapazil, marketed as Aricept. What's that used for?
It's the major drug prescribed for Alzheimer's patients. Is it an effective drug for treating Alzheimer's? No, but it's the major one prescribed. It's based on some clinical studies that showed that it would delay the rate of progression of Alzheimer's by about 3 weeks. Anybody know how long it typically takes people to die from Alzheimer's? About 7 years on average. Progressive degenerative disorder. So it delays it by about 3 weeks on a couple of cognitive measures. Turns out that it doesn't delay any of the biological changes at all, we've been able to determine. But 3 weeks is better than nothing. And that's what most treatments for Alzheimer's have achieved so far. So it's widely prescribed.
What about Mementa?
Which is memantine, which was a drug that blocked what site? PCP site on the yes. NMDA receptor. It's been so long ago.
No, it's not memory.
Okay. That one seems to help later in the progression of the disease more than early. Again, probably at the point where you're starting to get massive amount of degeneration. And that does seem to slow the rate of degeneration later in the disease. By that point in time, though, most people are institutionalized.
I know someone who's been prescribed it for cognitive bloating from, like, a mood disorder. So,
and?
But I wonder if you've heard of that.
I didn't say it was you, but did it help them?
Yeah, it did. But I was wondering if you've heard of that.
Well, have you also heard of a phenomenon called the placebo effect?
No, never, ever.
We'll talk a lot more about placebo effect later on. That may be the major value of drugs like donepezil, telling people they're getting something for their Alzheimer's. And if they can remember that fact, that might actually be of some benefit to them. Okay. I think if you learn just those two drugs off of a chart like this, that's sufficient. If you ever see stigmine, you know there's one in that general category. Physostigmine, neostigmine, things like that are often used as adjuncts for surgery, for instance. Help control the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so we've talked about biosynthesis, we've talked about degradation, and a lot of different drugs that can block degradation. Anything else we need to talk about biologically besides the receptors? How about transport? Turns out since acetylcholine is broken down in the synapse, it's not taken back up into neurons, so we don't have synaptic transporters. We do, though, have vesicular transporters. It has to get packaged up into vesicles. So we have vesicular acetylcholine transporters. I don't know how you're going to pronounce that, VACs. I don't have a good Germanic accent. It would probably be more effective.
Say Vacht, like Yacht.
Vacht, okay. Vesicular acetylcholine transporters. These turn out to be fairly complex in their function. They're proton-dependent transporters. And we've seen some proton-dependent transporters before, but these require two protons for every cycle to bring one molecule of acetylcholine in. And they need the protons inside the vesicle. So that requires a proton pump to run twice to bring in two protons. The proton pump is an ATPase. So what would that use as its substrate? ATP, so it's using up energy in your cell. And it's even worse, because this particular ATPase requires the ATP to be on the inside of the vesicular membrane. So you also have to have ATP transporters in these cholinergic vesicles to transport the ATP to the inside of the vesicle. These are not extremely well regulated, so these vesicles end up being typically very acidic on the inside. They'll end up with an excess of protons plus an excess of ATP, so it's sort of wasteful when you release acetylcholine. And too much acetylcholine release can actually change the pH of your cerebrospinal fluid. Or keeping ACH around too long. So these proton-dependent transporters require additional molecules to function properly. They can also be blocked by a drug, isamicol. Isamicol. We'll hear more about this drug over the next week's time. So bisamicol inhibits the binding of acetylcholine to the transporter, so it can't be taken into the vesicle. Okay, so I think we've covered all the basic biology now except for the receptors. How many kinds of muscarinic receptors did I say we have? Muscarinic receptors. Everybody, of course, did their reading for today, right? There are five of them. Thank you. Five classes of muscarinic receptors. They're numbered 1 through 5. They're called muscarinic receptors because they are sensitive to things in mushrooms such as Amanita muscaria. Get an idea from the name there. In fact, these sometimes called death's cap mushrooms don't just contain muscarin, they also contain significant levels of muscimol. Remember muscimol, a GABA A agonist, okay, which can put you to sleep. Of ibotenic acid, which is an agonist for mGluR1 and 5 receptors, a very potent one that I showed had a particular detrimental effect in the nervous system. Anybody remember that detrimental effect right before spring break?
For which one?
Ibotenic acid. It's commonly used in neuroscience labs to lesion neurons. And if you ingest these mushrooms, you can do the same thing in a non-experimental fashion. Well, it would be an experiment, probably only repeated once or twice. Plus muscarin. Or if you'd rather get a purer natural drug experience, there are other mushroom species that just contain muscarin. And the five varieties of muscarinic receptors that respond to these compounds and are labeled 1 through 5. And guess what? Nature took mercy on you here and gave you an easy way to remember them. In the sequence of numbers from 1 to 5, there are odd numbers and even numbers. The odd numbers, 1, 3, and 5, all share the same mechanism of action. They're all tied to GQs. We might think of those as excitatory muscarinic receptors. Because what does GQ do to enzyme activity? What enzyme does it activate? GQ, phospholipase C, which breaks down PIP2 into two products, IP3 and DAG. What does IP3 do? Increases calcium release from calcium stores by activating IP3 receptors. And what does that DAG do? PKC activation along with calcium and ATP. Okay. So the M1 or M3 or M5 receptors would probably increase phosphorylation in neurons. M2s and M4s, which are the even numbered ones, again share a mechanism of action. And they're both tied to GIs. Which again, I is a good mnemonic for inhibitory. So we have excitatory muscarinic receptors and inhibitory ones. Not inhibitory because they directly have an integral ion channel, but because they inhibit activity of what enzyme? Adenylate cyclase. So what does that do to PKA activity? Decreases PKA activity, because that's the cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase. So the odd-numbered ones increase phosphorylation. The even-numbered ones decrease phosphorylation. So if you remember odds and evens, that may help. You still have to remember which is inhibitory and excitatory, though. Okay. But at least that helps. If we look at the receptors, and we're looking at in situs here, so we're actually looking at the message for the receptor proteins, you can see that M1s are very widely distributed. And essentially, the brain is black. They're found pretty much everywhere. One of the other excitatory types, the M3s, less widely distributed, only in particular populations of neurons. The inhibitory types, again, pretty widely distributed, but again, the M2s, much more widely distributed than the M4s. So there's regional specificity to expression of these different types of muscarinic receptors. Much more selective than most of the pharmacology that's been applied to it so far. We're just in the rudimentary stages of applying our knowledge at this point. Okay. So when we think about the effector mechanisms, again, don't draw the pictures. You've already got pictures like this in your notes earlier. We've got one group of receptors that inhibit adenylate cyclase activity. Those the evens or the odds? The even-numbered ones, the M2s and M4s. And then we've got another group that activates phospholipase C, evens or odds? The odd-numbered ones. And another important effect of muscarinic agonists that we talked about earlier is inhibition of the M current, IM, one of the potassium conductances that was voltage dependent, cavitropic dependent, and also one more category. Starts with a C if that helps.
Calcium
dependent. Again, that seems to be mediated by the GQ alpha subunit effect. It's phosphorylation dependent. So phosphorylation by PKC shuts down the M current. So those are the primary mechanisms of action for muscarinic drugs. Even numbers different from the odd numbers. So what do we do with muscarinic drugs in terms of applying them? Clinical uses, they're used for everything from reducing secretions, or in the old days, dilating the eyes, for treatment of motion sickness. As I pointed out, they're the primary treatment still for Alzheimer's disease, for treatment of autonomic disorders. The eye dilation again. Treatment of severe diarrhea for their effects on heart rate. And obviously for treatment of overdoses on natural compounds like mushrooms. They have a several thousand year history of use as a beauty treatment. We talked about the strange use of Botox to get rid of the fact that people have facial expressions. Apparently that's not a beautiful feature. The Egyptians started this one, or at least that's the only ones that we still have records of, about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. The upper classes in Egypt, one of the notable things that made them the upper class, they could spend more of their time in the shade. They didn't have to be out laboring as much. And as a consequence, one of the things that happens to your eyes when you're in the shade is your pupils dilate. That made, apparently, women much more beautiful, having dilated pupils. So then in the normal competitive nature of the human race, some women wanted to have pupils that were even more dilated, that they were even shadier, apparently. And they found that certain plant extracts that contained atropine could achieve that effect. And in fact, a dose of those plant extracts would last for several days. So you could be beautiful for 2 or 3 days. A really long date, apparently. And it would have to be reapplied. That's not the drug that you typically get when you go to the ophthalmologist, even though most people think that's what they're getting. Most people get a much shorter acting drug, and we'll look at some different possibilities for that in just a second. We've also fairly recently discovered a drug called brucine. Brucine is an allosteric modulator. It affects the affinity of muscarinic receptors for muscarinic agonists. It enhances it. It makes agonist drugs more effective. So, make a lower dose of a given drug have the same effect. All right, so how many types of receptors were there?
Five.
Two general categories, though, right? Odds and evens. So let's look at agonists first for these five types of receptors. Again, don't panic. Keep in mind, five types of receptors, right? Let's look first at drugs that affect all of those receptors. Doesn't matter if they're odds or evens. What's the endogenous ligand for them? Acetylcholine. These are cholinergic receptors. So not surprising, acetylcholine binds to and agonizes every one of them. How about this drug? Have we heard of it before? Carbachol. What was special about carbachol? It's not broken down by cholinesterases. So it's widely used experimentally to study cholinergic systems. It again affects equally well all of the different types of muscarinic receptors. Not just one, not just two, but all five. How about this drug, muscarin? We mentioned that previously. That's why they're called muscarinic receptors. So not surprisingly, it affects all five types of receptors. Very, very potent drug. It's pretty hard to get muscarin in a pure form out of a mushroom, though. So most people, to do experimental work, and they want to do it just on muscarinic receptors, not on nicotinic receptors, which, remember, those top two act on nicotinic receptors too, would use a drug like oxotremarine. Again, oxotremarine agonizes all five types of receptors. So what if you wanted to get more specific and just turn on one type of receptor? With one exception, you're out of luck. We have drugs that are specific for M1s, like pilocarpine. If you know a little Latin, that probably means something like hairy fish. Pilocarpine. If you think of a carp as a fish. But we don't have any for the even numbers. In fact, we don't have any for the rest of the odd numbers, just M1s. So this chart's not really so terrible. You already knew about acetylcholine, you already knew about carbachol. If you thought about it a little bit, you knew about muscarin. So the only two new drugs really there are oxotremarine, which is not hard to remember, affects all of them, and pilocarpine, which only does the M1s. Okay? All right, that's agonists. Unfortunately, the story's worse when we get to antagonists. But again, don't panic. Let's break it down. We have five categories, and if you notice, not very much is in color here. If you think this is a lot of drugs listed, I could do 10 more slides and not run out of muscarinic antagonists. We've already talked about one of these up at the top. Atropine. One the ancient Egyptians knew about. Blocks all five types of muscarinic receptors. One that lasts almost as long as atropine is scopolamine. Scopolamine blocks all five types. Both of those are fairly long-acting drugs, so if you want a shorter-acting one, you might select a drug like cyclopentolate. Cyclopentolate is probably more widely used clinically these days. Cyclopentolate. Then we need to start paying attention to those 1 through 5 categories. Okay. We had pilocarpine that could be an agonist for M1s. We have pyrimizapine, starts with the same letters, an antagonist for M1s. Pilocarpine, an agonist. Pyrimizapine, an antagonist. They, in fact, start and end with the same letters. I don't know if that helps or confuses things. We have drugs like galamine that antagonize M2 receptors. Galamine could be a French drug. Galamine. We have drugs like aclidinium. Aclidinium specific for M3s. We have a drug that sounds like a description for where you might have wanted to have gone on spring break, tropicamide, specific for M4s. Tropicamide. What's missing? M5s. We don't have any that are specific for M5s. How could we block M5s? By blocking everything else with something like atropine or scopolamine or cyclopentolate. But we can't specifically block just M5s. How about if we wanted to block just the even-numbered ones, the inhibitory ones? How many drugs would it take us?
Two.
Could be one or two. Okay. If we didn't care about blocking the others, we could do one drug. But if we wanted to specifically only block the even-numbered ones, we'd need two drugs.
But you can use
hembosine. Well, hembosine, though, unfortunately, also cross-reacts with other categories of receptors besides just the even-numbered ones. That's why I didn't put it in color. It's not a clean drug. That's a good catch, though. Okay. So for different types of receptors, you can be selective or non-selective in your drug choice. And over on the left are sources of some of these. For instance, atropine comes from belladonna. Scopolamine from an ancient alchemical herb, mandrake roots. Both atropine and scopolamine are found in a plant that actually grows pretty extensively in Texas. Particularly a hazard if you keep horses or cattle. Seems to be tasty to them. They run around and act like they're crazy or loco. Same thing happens if humans ingest it. A friend of mine's son ingested, was told that Datura was a good drug to try. He was found running down the interstate naked.
Yeah.
Not a real happy drug. At least he wasn't running on the interstate. He was running down the median.
Oh my God.
All right, remember back when we talked about the autonomic nervous system and the parasympathetic targeting of muscles with muscarinic receptors. Okay. In the case of muscarinic receptors on smooth muscles that are normally relaxed when you apply muscarinic agonists, the odd-numbered ones, you can produce muscle contraction. In other areas, it's the even-numbered ones. But you apply acetylcholine or specific agonists, cause constriction, remove the cholinergic agonist, and they relax again. In most cases, it's by generation of calcium action potentials. So in the case of the odd-numbered ones, phosphorylation must do something to calcium channels in muscles. And that's different from what happens typically to phosphorylation of calcium channels in neurons. Remember we talked about presynaptic P-type calcium channels last class? And the autoreceptor effect of GABA-B receptor activation? And phosphorylation of those P-type channels inhibited them and caused less neurotransmitter release. Well, in muscle cells, a lot of these are L-type channels. And in muscle L-type channels, phosphorylation actually increases calcium channel activity. So things can be very specific in different cell types. Remember GERKs? Yeah. We talked about GERC previously. What did GERC stand for? G-protein activated inhibitory receptor mediated potassium channels. That's why GERC is a lot easier phrase. In this case, the even numbered muscarinic receptors appear to be involved in activation of GERCs. Okay, well, these are the inhibitory type of muscarinic receptors, and they generate an inhibitory postsynaptic potential via these GERCs, a membrane potential that inhibits neuron activity as well. Again, this seems to be mediated not by the alpha subunits, but by the beta-gamma subunits. Okay, and what was important for beta-gamma subunit activation of GERCs? What did the GERCs need to be? Phosphorylated. Gee, is there any other muscarinic receptor that could provide phosphorylation? The odd-numbered ones. So here you don't even have to depend on another neurotransmitter system. The odd-numbered ones could phosphorylate these GERCs, and the even-numbered ones could cause them to be more active. There's also effects on T-type calcium channels. This is in an interneuron, pretty complex looking interneuron, increasing low voltage activated calcium channel activity. Increasing low voltage activated calcium channel activity tends to rapidly depolarize the neuron, and very often this is involved in the normal function of what we call spontaneously active neurons. And muscarinic agonists can increase the rate of that spontaneous activity. Again, this is not an alpha subunit effect, but a beta gamma subunit effect. So it's important to be differentiating things that are dependent on the alpha subunits, which act strictly through their enzyme, either activation or inactivation effects, and the beta gammas, which can have other, more indirect effects. Okay. Right, we saw that in muscle cells, the effect on calcium channels is to increase them. And we see with these T-type calcium channels, the effect is to increase them. How about the high voltage activated type currents? For instance, the ones that are found presynaptically that might be involved in neurotransmitter release. Here, the phosphorylation of, for instance, P-type currents on the presynaptic terminal decreases the current. If you apply something like pilocarpine, specific for M1s, you decrease the presynaptic calcium current. If you decrease calcium currents presynaptically, what's that do to transmitter release? It reduces it. Okay? This is a violation of the general rule where we talked about ones and twos being typical primary receptors, and or A's being primary receptors, and B's and 2's being autoreceptors. For cholinergic, it can be these odd-numbered ones as autoreceptors, causing a reduction in the release of acetylcholine. Every rule we learn in pharmacology, we learn violations to it, too. It's as if the whole field is designed to ensure you can't get a good grade. Yes, you can. I'm trying to explain all of these exceptions, and hopefully you're writing them down in your notes. Okay. Who wants to go into all the details of M currents and how they're blocked? How about if we just say it's a phosphorylation dependent event and leave it at that? Okay. How about who wants to go into all the details about blockade of the slow AHP? How about we just say it's a phosphorylation dependent event? Which of the types of muscarinic receptors would cause more phosphorylation? The odd numbered ones, 1, 3, or 5. So they would tend to block the AHP. Which ones would increase, or at least not decrease, phosphorylation? 2 and 4. So they could keep the AHP normal or even bigger. And in fact, if we apply anticholinesterases, just keep more acetylcholine out in the synapses, the typical effect is to reduce the after hyperpolarization. This is a drug we did a lot of work with several years ago that was actually more effective on Alzheimer's patients than Aricept. Slowed the rate of progression down by about 12 weeks. Well, compared to 5 weeks, that's a significant improvement. Trouble is, it caused significant muscle weakness too. So if you have Alzheimer's patients that are falling down the stairs, their long-term survival is probably not going to be better. So it never hit the market. In terms of the effect on the nervous system, it was actually greatly superior. But it's not going to ever be out there for patients. Oh well. And if again you wonder why it's you have all those precautionary labels on bug spray containers or on insecticide powder containers, because of what treatment with even a short-acting anticholinesterase could do to acetylcholine levels. Tens and hundreds of times increase from what they would normally be in a very, very short period of time. The kind of dose you get from a weapon of mass destruction activation, like a cloud of nerve gas, it might be millions of times normal levels for a couple minutes' time. Enough so that every muscle in your body is trying to fire all the time. By that point in time, you're gone. That's it for today. On a happy note.